From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, jazz musician James Moody. The saxophonist is hard of hearing and was told as a child he would soon be deaf. But that didn't happen, and he launched his career in the early days of bebop with the Dizzy Gillespie Big Band. Also, there's a new audiobook of Vladimir Nabokov's Lolita, read by Jeremy Irons. Irons stars in a controversial film adaptation that has not yet found an American distributor. We'll feature an interview with Nabokov's son, Dmitri. And film critic John Powers reviews My Best Friend's Wedding, starring Julia Roberts. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. There's word of a tentative settlement in the historic tobacco talks. NPR's Debbie Elliott is live with us. Debbie, what can you tell us?
Well, sources close to the negotiations say they will be ready to announce an accord this afternoon. In fact, a news conference has been scheduled for 1:30. Negotiators worked into the wee hours of the morning until about 3:30, they say, and then resumed talks early today in hopes of finalizing the deal before the weekend. One of the last pieces to be worked out this morning was disclosure of internal tobacco company documents that detail what the industry knew about the health effects of smoking. They were also trying to finalize just how much the industry will pay to settle not only the 40 state lawsuits seeking to recoup the public health cost of treating sick smokers, but also the class action lawsuits that the industry is facing. So we should know exactly what the two sides have agreed to early this afternoon.
Thank you. NPR's Debbie Elliott live at the Tobacco Talks here in Washington. The Summit of Eight formally opens tonight in Denver. Leaders from the industrial nations plus Russia will meet at a reception hosted by Colorado Governor Roy Romer. Talks will begin when President Clinton hosts a summit dinner. Mr. Clinton has asked Russian President Boris Yeltsin to lead the discussion with his view of the global economy. A United Nations advance team is beginning its investigation of reported massacres in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Soldiers of new President Laurent Kabila allegedly murdered Hutu refugees as they took control of the former Zaire. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports.
Kabila agreed to the investigation under U.S. and other foreign pressure 2 weeks ago, but since then he's called for conditions the U.N. says would hinder its probe. Kabila wants the lead investigator taken off the team. He wants his soldiers, those accused of committing the massacres, to accompany the UN officials as they try to interview witnesses. These issues must be negotiated before investigators actually begin their work. Meanwhile, the Washington Post has reported that Kabila instructed local officials to block access to the UN. Kabila has much to lose by the increasing number of eyewitness accounts confirming the massacres. The reports are sowing discontent at home, and the U.S., among others, says such human rights abuses will jeopardize any aid for Kabila's new government. I'm Jennifer Ludden in Abidjan.
One of the original members of the Four Tops has died. Lawrence Payton died at his home in Southfield, Michigan today. He was 59. There's no word on the cause of his death. The Four Tops sold more than 50 million records, including hits like Reach Out, I'll Be There. The Four Tops received their own star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame just this last April. On Wall Street, the Dow was up 30 points at 7807. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the stock market is trading at record levels this hour. The Dow is currently up at 7807. Bloomberg's Doug Krisner reports.
Trading is very active due to strategies tied to the expiration of options and futures contracts, the quarterly event known as triple witching. Among the active issues, Boeing is higher after the company received a $1 billion order from British Airways. Meantime, airline stocks have gained after Salomon Brothers made positive comments about the industry's economic fundamentals, despite new attempts by Congress to raise aviation taxes. And semiconductor shares are benefiting from a prediction by Intel chairman Andrew Grove that the personal computer will overtake the video machine as the preferred vehicle for the video game industry. I'm Doug Krisner.
Exxon Corporation is asking a federal court to lower the punitive damages assessed against it for the Exxon Valdez accident. The ship ran aground in Alaska's Prince William Sound more than 8 years ago, spilling 11 million gallons of oil. Exxon says the more than $5 billion in punitive damages were 200 times more excessive than ever before awarded in such a case. The company says it did everything possible to make up for the accident, including paying $2.5 billion to clean up the mess and settling criminal charges by paying $1 billion. Exxon CEO Lee Raymond says firms that acknowledge their responsibility for wrongdoing and work to take care of it will still be punished disproportionately. Again, our top story this hour, there is word of a potential settlement in the tobacco talks here in Washington. Negotiators hope to present the tentative settlement later today. This is NPR.
Support for this program comes from this and other National Public Radio member stations and the Lila Wallace Reader's Digest Fund, helping people to make the arts part of their everyday lives.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's jazz festival season from Philadelphia to Porto, Portugal. On this archive edition, we have an interview with jazz festival veteran, the great saxophonist James Moody. What first put Moody on the map was his 1949 recording of I'm in the Mood for Love. His reworking of the melody was so good, it became the melody of a new song with a lyric by Eddie Jefferson called Moody's Mood for Love. Here's that 1949 recording. James Moody began his career in 1947 in the early days of bebop, playing with Dizzy Gillespie's big band. By the end of the 40s, he'd left the band and moved to Europe. Moody returned to the States in the early 50s to lead his own band. He played with Gillespie again during much of the 60s, but in the 70s, Moody left the jazz scene to work a steady job in a Vegas hotel band. When he returned to the jazz world, critic Gary Giddens wrote that there are few living musicians he enjoys hearing perform more than Moody. I spoke with Moody last year after the release of his delightful recording of songs associated with Sinatra. Here's Moody singing on the title track, Young at Heart.
Fairy tales can come true. It can happen to you. If you're young at heart, doo-dee-bee-bee-dee-bo-doo-doo-dee-bee-bee, for it's hard you will find to be narrow of mind. If you're young at heart, biddy biddy little boat and dip, you can go to extremes with impossible schemes. You can laugh when your dreams fall apart at the seams, and life gets more exciting with each passing day, and love is either in your heart or on its way. Don't you know that it's worth every treasure on earth to be young at heart?
James Moody, welcome to Fresh Air. And I want to say that I think this new album is delightful, and it's really delightful to hear you sing and to sing a song that's not a novelty song. Are you singing more now?
Well, maybe this might be the beginning of something. You know, maybe, who knows? You know, when you have strings like that, it makes you think you can sing, you know.
What do you think of your voice?
Well, it's a funny thing is I'm not as concerned with my voice as I am with my lisp that I have, you know, because I'm partially deaf. And I was born that way, and it doesn't mean that I have a speech impediment. It's just that I don't hear S's. So because my wife always tell me when I'm singing Mood for Love, I'd say, you give me a smile, and it says, it sounds like you're saying you give me a mile when I'm wrapped up in your magic, you know, in the lyrics. So anyway, that, you know, but I guess at this stage of the game, I just say what I say and hope that it comes out.
Well, has that held you back from singing? Are you self-conscious about that list?
No, really not at all, because I say what I say. I've been doing it for 71 years of talking. So if I say, you know, fairy tales can come true, you know, I don't know, too, you know, it can happen to you if you're young at heart. Doodle-dee-dee, doodle-doo-wee-dee.
Oh, I love that. Now, are there tones that you can't hear musically in an instrument?
Well, I don't know. I don't know because I can't. I don't know what I don't hear. Does that make sense to you?
No, I know what you're saying. I want to ask you a little bit more about your hearing. How old were you when you realized you had a hearing problem?
I was born that way, and I never realized it. I still haven't realized it because I hear what I hear, and that's it. See, if you don't know what you're missing, how can you say what you miss?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
There was insistence that that I wear a hearing aid because I would hear so much better. And I put this hearing aid on, and I'm telling you, I thought I was going to go nuts with the clanging and banging that I heard, you know, banging, clack, clack, boom. And you could hear the tires of the car. Blah, 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 blah. I says, oh, my goodness, if people hear this, I mean, it's nerve-wracking. So what I did was I turned it off, and they said, well, isn't that much better? I said, it certainly is.
So you've intentionally not worn a hearing aid.
Oh, no. And there's nothing that can be done, like no surgery or anything. So, like, what I do is, like... What did they say, honey? What did they say? Honey, what was that? What was that? My wife, my honey Linda, boy, she tells me, you know, whatever it is, if I feel that I've missed something. You heard that joke, didn't you, Terry, about the guy says, oh, man, he says, boy, I just spent $4,000 on this wonderful hearing aid, you know. And the guy said, yeah. Says, what kind is it? The guy said, it's 12 o'clock.
It took me a second.
Yeah.
Right. So did music sound different with the hearing aid?
Oh, I wouldn't dare do that. I wouldn't dare put a hearing aid on and play music because just the way I hear it, that's the way I hear it. Because if I put the hearing aid in, then it's banging and clanging again and clinking. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. James Moody, let's take a pause here and listen to more from your new CD, Young at Heart, your new CD of Sinatra-related songs. And let's hear a ballad this time. This is In the Wee Small Hours of the Morning. Do you want to say anything about it?
Well, first of all, in the wee small hours of the morning, I like the melody, you know, da-da-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-da. And I liked it when Frank Sinatra did it. And I just figured, well, like, we'd like to do it another kind of way. And Gil Goldstein, he did a very wonderful job arranging it. So that's how that came about.
Well, here's James Moody from his new album, Young at Heart. James Moody from his new CD, Young at Heart. You started to play saxophone in high school, I think, but I think it wasn't until you were in the Air Force that you started playing for real.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us the story of the band that you played in the Air Force, and this was right after you got out of college.
Well, the band that I played in the Air Force was an unauthorized Air Force band because when I was in the Air Force, it was segregated. So three quarters of the base was Caucasian and one quarter was Negro. And they wanted to have a Negro band, so they formed one. And then Linton Garner, Earl Garner's brother, he was drafted and he came to the base where we were. And then Pop Reeves, he was drafted and he wrote some things for Benny Goodman. And I never will forget Linton Garner. One day he asked me, he says, Moody, he said, play your scales for me. So I said, da, 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 da. And he said, well, I said, well, what? He said, is that it? I said, yeah. He said, my boy, you're in for a rude awakening. You know, so anyway, but little by little. But, you know, I'd like to say one thing, Terry. When I was in Greensboro, North Carolina, I was 18 years old, right? And I was living in Newark, New Jersey. Do you know that the German prisoners of war used to come into town and jump off the truck, you know, with the PW on their back and those hats, and go into the restaurant and eat, and we couldn't?
Wow.
Yeah.
How did you feel about serving in the Air Force, knowing that your own country wouldn't let you into certain restaurants?
Well, what could you do? You see, because in the first place, like, there was nothing you... After I left and went to Europe and was living in France, I would send my wife, I would send my mother a letter, and I'd have on there, it had, the land of the brave. I'd put the land of the au fait, you know, or something, USA, you know. And my mother said, Jim, don't do that. I mean, you're getting in trouble, you know. But, hey, it was the truth, you know, because, it was their land, you know, not mine.
My guest is saxophonist James Moody. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back to our interview with James Moody, recorded last year after the release of his CD, Young at Heart. You joined the Gillespie Big Band after you got out of the Air Force.
Yep.
And it was a very innovative band. It was one of the first big bands really playing the new music of bebop. What was it like for you to be in this band? What were the most exciting parts of it for you?
Well, the most exciting thing about that band was when I grew older and found out where I was when I first was in that band. Because, like I've said before, when I joined the band, Thelonious Monk was the piano player, Ray Brown was the bass player, Milt Jackson was the viber harpist, and Kenny Klugemop Clark, he was the drummer. That was the rhythm section, along with Howard Johnson, Cecil Payne, all the people like that. Now, if I would have known where I was, like, I would have fainted. You see?
Sure.
So I'm glad I was naive. I wasn't that hip, so I didn't know where I was. I mean, I knew, but I didn't. You understand what I'm saying?
Yes, I do.
Uh-huh.
And what was Dizzy Gillespie like as a band leader? I think you've called him your musical father.
Oh, yeah. Diz was wonderful, man. Then we knew each other and it was all right, you know, but I got to really know him better when I played in the quintet. You know, and musically, he was bad, boy. He was bad. And Diz was always studying, too. Like, he would always, you know, he'd sit down at the piano, look at this, look at that, look at this. And he'd tell me, he said, Moody, this is where everything is. See the piano? I don't care what the instrument is, that's where it is. Trombone, violin, trumpet, saxophone, flute, this is where it is. You look at it, you see everything. When you play the piano, all the notes are laid out there for you. You know, and all those notes on every one of the instruments. So Diz said, you want to really know what's happening, you learn the piano. You know.
Did you?
Yeah, that's what he did. Pardon me?
Did you learn it?
Well, I can play the changes, yeah. I can sit down and I can pick out what I have to do. You know. Before, I used to have to call a friend, hey, could you play the changes for me so I can hear what they sound like? You know, but I don't have to do that. I can play them myself now.
Your first solo was recorded with the Dizzy Gillespie Band. The tune is called Eminon, which is no name spelled backwards.
Mm-hmm.
This was, I think, in 1947. Do you remember your solo on that record? Could you sing
it? I remember it. Yeah, I remembered it because I wasn't supposed to take the solo. The baritone player was supposed to take it, and he didn't show up or something. And the solo was something like that.
And how come you remember it? Do you remember it from actually playing it or from listening to the record?
No, because a lot of times when we see each other, like sometimes I'm talking to Jimmy Heath, it's section we call each other because he's a wonderful saxophonist, or some of the guys, and we're talking, and somebody says, oh, yeah, man, you remember Eminon when we were Dizzy? And we'd all sing it for a moment together, you know.
Now, the most famous solo that you've ever taken was on your first recording of I'm in the Mood for Love. And then Eddie Jefferson, a singer who was working with you, wrote a lyric to your solo, and that became the song known as Moody's Mood for Love. Let's hear the Eddie Jefferson version of Moody's Mood for Love, his lyric to your solo.
There I go, there I go, there I go, there I go. Pretty baby, you are the soul, it snaps my control. Such a funny thing, but every time you're near me, I never can behave. You give me a smile and then I'm wrapped up in your magic. There's music all around me, crazy music, music that keeps calling me so very close to you, turns me your slave. Come and do with me any little thing you want to. Anything, baby, just let me get next to you. Am I insane or do I really see heaven in your eyes? Bright as stars that shine up above there in the clear blue sky. How I worry about you, just can't live my life without you, baby. Come here, don't have no fear. Wonder why I'm really feeling in the mood for love. And tell me why I stopped to think.
Now, what impact did Moody's Mood for Love have on your career?
Well, if I don't do it to this day, people said I haven't been there. I mean, that goes to show you. Like, no matter how much I practiced, if I don't say, there I go, or play, you know, then it's like I haven't been there. But like, I'm not, it doesn't make me feel like, oh, I don't want to be doing this. But I mean, I love doing it. And it's been very good to me, that that solo. And I'm honored and privileged, I believe, you know, to be able to do it.
You were living in Europe when you recorded I'm in the Mood for Love. And then
Paris.
In Paris. And then after after it took off in the States, you moved back.
Yeah.
To the States and started leading your own band here. Why were you reluctant to move back?
Because of what I had told you before.
Racism.
Racism, yeah.
And that's why you moved to Europe in the first place?
No, I didn't move to Europe for that. I moved to Europe. I didn't move to Europe. What happened was, I'm being honest with you, was that my uncle lived in Europe. He lived there and he was working for the government, my uncle and my aunt. And, like, I had a problem, you know, with alcohol, and I kind of over, I cut that loose, and my my uncle said, sis, send him over here for a couple of weeks, said, just let him relax and cool out, and things, you know, he'll be all right. So I went to Paris to stay for 2 weeks and stayed 3 years. You see, and then while I was there, I said, wow, I said, man, this is altogether different. You could go wherever you wanted to go, and you know, and things were just different. And but the only thing that drug me about Paris was that they treated the Arabs that way.
You mean they were racist toward Arabs?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
After you got back to the States, you started leading your own band, and I think it was in 1958 that there was a club that burned down in Philadelphia. And
I think it was the Blue Note, wasn't it?
That's what I'd read. And you lost a lot of,
lost,
I guess,
everything.
The band's instruments, the band's arrangements, the whole book for the band.
Yeah.
What, You must have been in shock after that.
No, I just reached on and picked up one of the bottles of alcohol and drank it.
Mm. Right.
And said to heck with it. Yeah. But then that really wound up where I drank and drank, and finally I went to Overbrook, which is a place for the mental institutions, for mental things and for alcohol. And I went for alcohol.
Did you go yourself, or did somebody else take you there?
Yep, I went myself.
It was your idea.
Yeah, I'm sick of this. I can't use it. So I said, I'm going to go and do something about it. Yeah, so I did.
And did you play while you were there?
Play where?
While you were in the hospital, did you play music at all?
No. I didn't even want to look at a horn. No. I just started going into thinking, like, looking at astrology and trying to find the reasons why, you see, because I had been married, because I was married in France, too, and so I was just trying to, and I was, we were separated and getting a divorce, and I was just trying to find out the reasons why for a lot of things. So I looked at astrology, and I started looking at the Bible, you know, and that's how that went.
James Moody recorded last year after the release of his CD, Young at Heart. We'll hear more in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. And here's Moody's recording, Last Train from Overbrook, which he composed and recorded shortly after leaving rehab.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more with James Moody. Also, The Unabridged Lolita has been published as an audiobook read by Jeremy Irons, who stars in a controversial, not-yet-released film adaptation. We'll feature an interview with Vladimir Nabokov's son, Dmitry. And John Powers reviews My Best Friend's Wedding, starring Julia Roberts. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of our interview with saxophonist James Moody, recorded last year after the release of his CD, Young at Heart, featuring songs associated with Frank Sinatra. Moody has been recording since the early days of bebop in the late 40s when he joined the Dizzy Gillespie Band, but in the 70s he took an extended leave of absence from jazz. You spent about, 7 years in Vegas during during the 1970s?
Yep.
It must have been so interesting to be in the middle of show business, mm-hmm. as opposed to, you know, playing straight ahead jazz at a club. What did you think of all the show busyness of it all? Was that entertaining for you at all, or just very crass and commercial?
You know what it was. What it was for me was a heck of a lesson, because like when I was in Dizzy's band, we'd play something, and if it was like things to come, we would say and we'd get it down, and then we'd take it up and play it. In Las Vegas, they play it just like it's supposed to be played. That's it. Bam, you know. It's gone. That's it. And you got to play it, you know. So that was a good lesson for me. And that, and tuning up, being in tune, it was like I said, you know, God works in mysterious ways. And God just showed me, like, in his way, how I should do things. I mean, he just put me in situations that I had to, you know, do or leave. You know what I mean?
What were the songs you had to play all the time, no matter who was singing?
Oh, well, in Vegas, whatever it is, whatever the pop song of the day is, you can rest assured that when the artist, whoever's coming in to headline for the week or 2 weeks, they'll be doing that song. You know, like, dum bum bee dee 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 dee. That song, I mean,
close to you, yeah.
Close to you, I mean, whatever the year was and whatever the pop song was, I mean, they just, you played it to death.
Now, have you added any of those songs to your own repertoire?
Nope.
Right. Now, I want to take a pause here and play something that's basically an outtake. But it's such an entertaining outtake. And this is something you recorded in 1958. The tune is called The Moody One. And you stop.
I goofed?
Yeah.
On the record date?
Well, let's play the outtake and hear the goof.
I goofed on the record date, and they left that in there. Yeah, I remember
that. Here it is. Mm-hmm. Were your outtakes usually as entertaining as this one?
Oh, sure. That's like the bloopers, you know. That was my blooper. That was my way of doing it, you know. But anybody, when they do something like that, they always say something that's a little comical, you know.
Were you surprised that this actually ended up on the record?
Well, yeah, because, like, you know, finally they said, yeah, we're going to leave it on there, too. I said, what? Yeah, I said, well, go ahead. I don't care. And then I'd go and play places. People says, I goofed on the record date.
I want to ask you something else about Dizzy Gillespie.
Uh-huh.
You were very close with Dizzy Gillespie. Were you close to him when he died?
Yeah. We were with him. I had him in my arms. There was John Faddis was there.
The trumpeter.
Yeah, Jacques Mouyel and his son, John Motley, and myself. Yeah. There were five of us in there with him when he passed. And you know what's funny? I told John, I said, John, you mark my word, 10 years from now, there are going to be 50 people in the room with this. You know, and there was no music playing. There was nothing. I mean, Diz was just sitting there, but, you know, trying to breathe deep, trying to get his breath. and his eyes were closed, you know, and he never opened them, and finally he took the last one, man, and that was, you know, so, yep, that was it, man.
Was he conscious toward the end? Did he know that you were there?
Well, the night before he knew that we were there. The night before, because Mike Lungo and myself, we went to see him. And we said, ooh, papa da, you know, yabba-dee-bobby. And he tried to mouth, ooh, papa da. And then the thing he did was he took his finger and put it up to his lips and made his, tried to make his jaws go out like he usually did. You know how he would do?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and but he was too weak, but we smiled, you know, and all like that. And I said, Mikkel, let's go, man. We'll come back tomorrow. I said that to Mike Lungo, you know. And so, you know, then when I went back the next day, like, he was in bed that night. And then when I went back the next day, he was sitting up. They had him in a chair sitting up. And he was, you know, trying to breathe. So, anyway, yeah, but I mean it. I just it's not the same. Nothing is the same anymore without Diz, man. You know.
You must feel like you owe so much of your career to him because he gave you your first job, and then you played with him off and on for so long.
Yeah, he did. When I was 21 years old, first gig. Yep. Yep. And even now, like I tell people, that when they ask me, they said, well. What do you remember of this? You know, I mean, there are many things, and what happened is sometimes I'll say, ah, that's what he meant. You know, it might be because everywhere that I've gone in the world, no matter where it was, I was there first with this. This took me everywhere first, man. You know, I go to Africa, you know, just Sweden, Germany, France, all except Paris. I went there first alone. But then after that, everywhere else was there. And now when I go to those places and I'm going, boy, I say, oh, man, you know. And for the longest time, I used to call my wife. I used to call Linda, my honey, and tell her, says, honey, I called you and you weren't home. You know, she says, honey, I've been home all day. I said, well, I said, but I called, and then I'd say the number. And she'd say, honey, that's Dizzy's number.
Oh, wow. Yeah. James Moody, recorded last year after the release of his CD, Young at Heart. His next CD is due out in September. This summer, he'll play at jazz festivals around the world. Our thanks to drummer and record collector Kenny Washington for making us a copy of his rare 1949 James Moody recording. Coming up, Dmitri Nabokov talks about his father, Vladimir Nabokov. This is Fresh Air. The unabridged edition of Vladimir Nabokov's novel Lolita has been published as an audiobook. It's considered one of the greatest 20th century books in the English language, yet English wasn't even Nabokov's first language. He grew up in Russia. The audiobook Lolita is read by Jeremy Irons, who also stars in a controversial film adaptation that has not yet found an American distributor. Nabokov himself had trouble finding a publisher for Lolita because the story of a middle-aged man's sexual obsession with a 12-year-old girl was considered pornographic. In fact, the first company willing to publish Lolita specialized in pornography. Here's Jeremy Irons reading from the beginning of Lolita.
Lolita, light of my life, fire of my loins, my sin, my soul. Lolita. The tip of the tongue taking a trip of three steps down the palate to tap at three on the teeth. Lolita. She was low, plain low in the morning, standing 4 feet 10 in one sock. She was Lola in slacks. She was Dolly at school. She was Dolores on the dotted line. But in my arms, she was always Lolita. Did she have a precursor? She did, indeed she did. In point of fact, there might have been no Lolita at all had I not loved one summer a certain initial girl child in a princedom by the sea. Or when? About as many years before Lolita was born as my age was that summer. You can always count on a murderer for a fancy prose style. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, exhibit number one is what the seraphs, the misinformed, simple, noble-winged seraphs, envied. Look at this tangle of thorns.
Jeremy Irons from the new audiobook Lolita. In 1989, I spoke with Vladimir Nabokov's son, Dmitri, who had just co-edited a book of his father's letters to relatives, friends, editors, publishers, and fellow writers. Many of the letters concerned the difficulty Nabokov had publishing Lolita in the 50s. I asked Dmitri if his father would have wanted his letters published.
I know that father wrote most of his letters with the same precision, the precision of the artist and the passion of the scientist. Because he was aware, as he was of many things, that what he wrote would go down in the record. When he was first writing Lolita, he referred to it in writing to one of his correspondents as a time bomb. So he had an inkling of what might happen, even though later he almost destroyed the book. So I think that he would have probably not disapproved the project. He might have edited it differently, but I hope not.
There are many letters in this collection about Lolita. Let me ask you to read a letter about Lolita that was written in 1956 about why he really didn't think anyone could possibly seriously see the book as being pornographic.
This letter was written to Professor Morris Bishop of Cornell, who was single-handedly instrumental in having Father come to Cornell as a professor and was his only intimate friend on campus. The letter written on 6 March 1956 reads partially as follows. I calmly lean on my conviction that it is a serious work of art and that no court could prove it to be, quote, lewd and libertine, unquote. All categories grade, of course, into one another. A comedy of manners written by a fine poet may have its lewd side, but Lolita is a tragedy. Pornography, quote unquote, is not an image plucked out of context. Pornography is an attitude and an intention. The tragic and the obscene exclude each other.
There's a letter about Lolita that was written to you by your father, who was pretty angry about something that you were participating in. This concerned the casting of the movie Lolita. And do you want to explain what you were doing and then read the letter about it?
Somewhat shamefacedly, yes. In my early years in Milan, I went to complete my singing studies and then to make my debut. In Milano, I became friendly with a somewhat suspect publicity agent who talked me into the following scheme. Lolita was just having a big play in the press in Italy, the Italian translation had come out, and there was talk of the film which Stanley Kubrick was preparing in America. The idea was this, that we would have a Lolita contest held at my apartment in Milan with a jury of my fellow opera singers, many of them from La Scala, including people like Anna Moffo, who gamely participated in this, with, of course, a predetermined winner, who was a lovely little ballerina at La Scala, and a good time to be had by all and to be covered by the Italian newsreels of the time. Being in my 20s, adventurous and fond of pretty girls, I said, okay, let's do it. Bad mistake. At dawn, provincial mothers with decidedly post-pubescent nymphets in tow started arriving at my house. I had no idea what to do with them. Finally, I found myself with this procession of candidates and everybody having a great time. And a few days later, my father saw in a Paris magazine his son surrounded by other buxom girls in a huge satin-covered bed, all clothed, all decent, but still. He had kept far away from casting matters. In fact, he didn't know how the thing would be cast. He he didn't envisage having a 12-year-old girl play Lolita then. Maybe now he would have. He thought at one point, as he wrote in one of his letters, that perhaps she should be played by a dwarfess. When he saw this, he wrote me a rather indignant telegram followed by the letter which I will now read you. My dear, this comes, by the way, from Mandeville Canyon Road in Los Angeles, where he had been completing work on the script. Today I sent you a telegram asking you to stop the, quote, Lolita publicity, unquote, and would like to say the following to you. This publicity is in very bad taste. It can only harm you in the eyes of those who take music seriously. It has already harmed me. Because of it, I cannot come to Italy, since the reporters would immediately pounce on me there, and I would have to deny categorically everything that you or your agent have been saying. Here, I have resolutely kept my distance from the search for an actress and from all casting matters. This was in the interest of my reputation and also in that of the producer. I cannot tell you how unpleasant, repugnant even, I find the reports in the Italian press linking you with a presumed search for an actress who has, incidentally, long since been found by Kubrick and Harris. No less important is that this unhealthy ruckus can only dilute your young fame.
Were there other ways that you felt you were used by
I'm pretty good at not being used. This was kind of fun, and I was the guilty party here.
Right.
I pretty well take care of myself, and he was absolutely right. Although he was such a nice, indulgent father, that he quickly forgave me, and we had many good laughs over the thing afterwards.
In one of the letters, your father writes to you what he calls an instructive little jingle. Would you recite that jingle for us and explain why he wrote it?
In Italy, for his own good, a wolf should wear a riding hood. I think it's even more cogent in these days of dread diseases, but even then, my parents were rather concerned that being a vigorous bachelor, I might pick up the wrong thing from the wrong girl.
Hence the riding hood. Okay.
It shows you, you know, how humorous and warm he was even in little things like that. He was a great father. We had laughs about everything.
Were you very self-conscious when you were growing up about speaking or about writing? You know, because your father was so precise with his language and also so funny with his use of it and so creative with it. I mean, his books are filled with puns and anagrams and complex wordplay. Did it make you self-conscious about just being able to speak extemporaneously?
I'll begin by commenting on speaking extemporaneously. When I was in prep school, I loved speaking and debating. Besides, that was one way of getting out of school for a weekend, that and sports. I was on the debating team, on the public speaking team, on the extemporaneous and impromptu speaking squad, and I won a New Hampshire and a New England championship in those things because I enjoyed doing it very much. That was long before I became delicately and intimately conscious of the intricacies of my father's style. However, what I can say is that he never made me self-conscious. He allowed me to collaborate both in the translations and sometimes in revising and checking and proofreading. He checked some of my early, very naive attempts at fiction and poetry. He never became an ogre, a monster, an overwhelming, frightening figure. He was always indulgent and nice and not overly critical and helped me along. I can also say this, that I think that the apprenticeship that I almost subliminally had with Father over the years, plus the supreme legacy that he gave me at his death, oddly, that of inspiration, was instrumental in changing my life completely and in making me switch from my beloved career of singing to a priority given to literature now.
What are you referring to when you say the legacy that your father left you at his death?
Well, besides the apprenticeship of having worked under the discipline that he always imposed and which I loved. The legacy is an almost intangible thing. After his death, it was as if an obscure, intangible soul of his writing had been at least partially transmitted to me, because I suddenly found myself writing original English, something I had never done before. I can't make it any more precise than that.
Mm-hmm. I heard that you're writing a novel, but under a pen name.
Yeah, I'm writing a novel which is fairly complex, not an imitation of Vladimir Nabokov.
Why are you writing it under a pen name?
To avoid undeserved fame and undeserved blame.
Well, are you under this kind of pressure of, you should really be a genius, your father was?
Maybe I should be, but that's not for me to judge. However, I can say this. I think an engineer's son or a businessman's son is expected to take over the trade, and they're often very brilliant successors to their fathers. In the arts, a son somehow is very vulnerable. He's vulnerable to attack, and he's also vulnerable to being given the illusion that he's good when he's not, simply because he's his father's son. So if the thing flies on its own wings, maybe I'll paint the correct name on the tail.
I thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Dmitri Nabokov recorded in 1989 after he co-edited a book of his father's letters. Lolita has just been published as an audio book read by Jeremy Irons, who stars in a controversial film adaptation that has not yet found an American distributor, but it will open in Europe in the fall. Coming up, a review of My Best Friend's Wedding. This is Fresh Air. Hollywood has certainly been cranking out a steady stream of summer action films, with more to come. As a change, this week, Julia Roberts returns to the big screen in a romantic comedy called My Best Friend's Wedding. Our film critic John Powers has a review.
In the old days, studios used to exercise complete control over their stars. They told them how to behave in public, covered up their peccadillos, and most important, decided what roles they would play. These days, the stars have the power, and frankly, many of them don't have a clue about how to nurture a career. Take Julia Roberts. 7 years ago, Pretty Woman launched her as the great natural comedian of her generation, beautiful, high-spirited, and blessed with an infectious, whooping laugh. And what did Roberts do with her sudden success? She stopped doing comedy and tried to become serious, boo-hooing her way through picture after picture, and reaching rock bottom as Irish country girls in Mary Riley and Michael Collins, two period dramas that seemed designed to prove that she can't do a brogue. Happily, Roberts is back on form in My Best Friend's Wedding. She stars as a food critic named Jules, who has a deal with her best friend Michael, a sports writer played by Dermot Mulroney. If neither is married by their 28th birthday, they'll marry each other. They're about to turn 28 when Michael calls to say that he's getting married. The panicky Jules suddenly realizes that she wants Michael for herself and jets off to Chicago to deep-six the wedding. But there are a couple of problems. Michael's fiancée, Kimmy, played by Cameron Diaz, is genuinely likable. Even worse, Michael clearly loves her. Still, this doesn't stop Jules from trotting out all sorts of harebrained shenanigans, even fobbing off her gay friend George, played by Rupert Everett, as her own fiancée. Naturally, the stolid Michael is taken aback.
Something wrong.
Well, I guess it's just the way that you always talked about George. It always seemed like, it sounded like George was gay. Actually, yes.
Exactly. Common misconception.
It is. Because George likes to pretend that he's gay.
And why would you do that?
Oh, I find it attracts women.
Indeed, yes. Worked for me. Big time.
The movie was directed by P.J. Hogan, the Australian whose first film, Muriel's Wedding, started off as a breezy, broad comedy laced with ABBA songs, then turned doleful. The same thing happens here. My Best Friend's Wedding opens with Jules veering between her exuberant schemes to pry Michael loose from his fiancée and her equally flamboyant despair when the innocent Kimmy unwittingly thwarts her at each turn. This is enjoyable stuff. Roberts and Diaz are both terrific. But just when the comedy should become faster and funnier, Ron Bass's script turns inexplicably moralistic. One of Jules' plans backfires in a nasty way, and she spends most of the rest of the movie being punished for her selfishness in trying to steal Michael back. We often hear that movies are more cynical than they used to be. But are they? 50 years ago, His Girl Friday could take a similar plot. An editor played by Cary Grant tries to stop the impending marriage of his ex-wife and play it strictly as farce. The movie's pleasure lay in Grant's merry amorality, as he did whatever it took to prevent his star reporter, Roz Russell, from marrying Ralph Bellamy. His unscrupulousness was the joke. These days, Hollywood is terrified that the audiences will be turned off by any comedy whose major character isn't likable and nice. And so Jules, the career woman, must spend the second half of the movie sobbing and feeling guilty to prove she's really a good person. But the audience doesn't want goodness from a comedy. It wants to laugh. Which is why the movie's dominated by Rupert Everett, a crack farceur whose George is the apotheosis of that current movie cliché, the heroine's gay friend. Because he's homosexual, and therefore an outsider, George is allowed a wicked sophistication. Not only is he more worldly about love than everyone else, he's also sardonic and playful. Next to the scene-stealing George, the straight, unimaginative Michael is about as charismatic as a stalk of celery. Although the filmmakers clearly didn't intend this, My Best Friend's Wedding is the first movie in Hollywood history where the audience starts thinking, wouldn't it be great if the heroine could wind up with the gay guy?
Joan Powers is film critic for Vogue. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced today by Joan Tui Westman. Our engineers this week are Bob Purdick, Joyce Lieberman, Fred Snyder, Chris Fraley, and Al Banks. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Alan Tu directed the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House, publishers of Carl Sagan's final book, Billions and Billions, Thoughts on Life and Death at the Brink of the Millennium. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, privacy. Consumer advocate Beth Givens warns about the personal information about us that can now be accessed through the Internet. And Jana Malamud-Smith wrestles with where to draw the line between private and public, questions she's dealt with as the daughter of a famous writer, the late Bernard Malamud. Join us for the next Fresh Air.